kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and this is an Empowerment Hour, the latest on how to live a longer, healthier, and happier life. We're going to talk about carrots. We haven't talked about carrots in a long time, kind of neglected it. And also, scientists in Austria suggest a new definition of old age. Well, we'll see what that's about. And self-worth boosts the ability to overcome poverty. That's good news. And could your digestive problems be solved by eliminating GMOs? We'll take a look. Junk food can harm your memory in 1 week. 1 week. Sensitive teeth, a lot of people have that. 2 Ayurvedic remedies curb hypersensitivity, and a lot more on that. Plus, today, my guest in the second part of our program is going to take a very positive look at a society that is becoming, well, negative, pessimistic, kind of depressed. My guest today will be Charles Eisenstein. He is a great scholar. He writes about civilization, economics, the evolution of human cultures, and the spiritual challenges of coping with a society and world in chaos. He's taught all over the place, Penn State, Goddard, and other places. So we're going to have him talk about how do we cope in such negative environments. By the way, tomorrow my guest will be Jonathan Greenberg talking about GMO labeling campaigns and why they're winning and we're not. And then Lori Wallach from Public Citizen, more bad news about Trans-Pacific Partnership, but what we can do in a good way to stop it. Also today, we're going to look at the U.S. government is paying through the nose, meaning you and I, for private contractors, something I've mentioned many, many times in this program, that if we really had the government that we need, we wouldn't be broke, there wouldn't be great disparity, but there is. Also, America's child soldiers. The Pentagon has a program that canvasses public high schools for future soldiers. Well, hold on. Doesn't that run right up against the Child Soldiers Prevention Act, the CSPA? Yeah, it does. But we'll get to that also. Also, we're going to talk about the whole idea of a society that allows false information to become common. The BBC News finally recognizes the false claims about the measles epidemic and changes the information on its websites. Do you remember several months ago we were told, oh, there's an epidemic in Wales and Scotland with measles? No, there was not any epidemic at all, and no one died at all. But everyone was vaccinated. Now the truth comes out, and we'll share that with you as well. Also, we are taking a look at America, the fascistic state that it's becoming, and how we, the people, can push back against it. All this is empowering information. Let's begin. I remember when I first came to New York City, there was a little health food store, and all they served in the way of juices was carrot juice, not even carrot and apple or carrot and celery, just carrot juice. And the guy behind the counter was convinced that carrots had everything you needed to stay healthy. Well, not so much. But there's a lot of good in carrots. This is from Medical News Today. So we're talking about mainstream medicine and science. Here's what they're saying. I'll quote this. Carrots are often thought of as the ultimate health food. You've probably been told to eat your carrots, but your parents are on top of this, and unfortunately a lot of kids are not. But how did the carrot get such a good reputation, and why exactly are the root vegetables so good for our health? It's believed that the carrot was first cultivated in the area known now as Afghanistan thousands of years ago as a small forked purple or yellow root with a woody and bitter flavor. Doesn't resemble anything that we know today as a carrot. purple, red, yellow, and white carrots were cultivated long before the appearance of the now popular orange carrot. In fact, that was developed and stabilized by Dutch growers in the 16th, 17th centuries. The modern carrot was bred to be sweet, crunchy, and aromatic. This Medical News Today information on carrots is interesting because it shows that, according to the Department of Agriculture, one medium carrot, that's about a half a cup of chopped carrots, is considered serving size, has low calories, and even has some protein, has lots of vitamins and minerals, but has lots of antioxidants. Now, here's what the benefits of eating carrots or drinking carrot juice will do for you. Again, I don't recommend drinking straight carrot juice because it can spike up your blood sugar. If you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, that's not good. But taking a carrot and mixing it with celery and cucumber, that's perfect. Cancer. A variety of dietary carotenoids have been shown to have anti-cancer effects due to their antioxidant power in reducing free radicals in the body. Lung cancer. One study in the peer-reviewed literature found that current smokers who did not consume carrots had a 300% increased risk of developing lung cancer compared to those that did. Colorectal cancer. Beta-carotene consumption from carrots has been shown to have an inverse association with the development of colon cancer in this Japanese study, meaning the more carrots, less colorectal cancer. Leukemia. Yes, carrot juice extract was shown to kill leukemia cells, inhibit the progression in a study. Prostate cancer. It also, according to Harvard School of Public Health, Department of Nutrition, it has a protective role of prostate cancer. And in vision, Duke ophthalmologist Dr. Jill Corey found that vitamin A deficiency causes the outer segment of the eye's photoreceptors to deteriorate, damaging normal vision. Correcting vitamin A deficiencies with foods high in beta-carotene will restore vision. So they're very good for your eyes. So that's our food of the day, carrots. Also, having an idea of self-worth boosts the ability to overcome poverty. This is from the University of British Columbia, and here's what it says. For people in poverty, remembering better times, such as past success, improves brain functioning by several IQ points and increases their willingness to seek help for crucial aid services. The findings suggest that reconnecting the poor with feelings of self-worth reduces powerful stigma and psychological barriers that make it harder for low-income individuals to make good decisions or access the very assistance services that can help them get back on their feet. Quote from the lead study published in the peer-reviewed journal Psychological Science, this study shows that surprisingly simple acts of self-affirmation can improve the cognitive function and behavioral outcomes of people in poverty. I remember about 4 weeks ago interviewing a person in an area of South New Jersey, South Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, who talked about what it's like today not to have a job, to have constant stigma, not to be able to have clothes that look nice, because he can't afford anything, and how he's never broken the law, he's never been arrested or convicted of a crime, he's an African-American male in his 50s, but he sees what poverty has done to his family, his neighborhood, and he says that we're not addressing poverty issues, we're only addressing crime issues, and then through that we stigmatize a whole generation of young people and their families. And then he went through, and I filmed all this, so it'll be in the new film, Poverty, Inc., just explaining what's it like to be just a middle-aged guy who's never caused anyone any problems, and yet he is a victim today of a society that considers him because of his color of his skin, his economic background, the circumstances in which he is living as a potential criminal. and how that impacts you when it goes to work. And he said that all the people he knows who have been incarcerated, almost all of them, he said, because of drugs they've used. And why do they use the drugs, I ask? He said, well, it's simple. If you wake up every day and you realize that today is not going to be any better than yesterday and probably worse, and you live in an area where there's constant gang warfare and drug turfing, and people can shoot you or beat you up for no reason at all, and you have to live there because you don't have any other place to go and you don't have any money to get there, he said, exactly what would you want to do? Escape. So how you get out of that, when you physically can't get out of it, you take drugs. And for a period of time, the drug takes you out of that mindset of how helpless you are in the circumstances in which you exist. And he said, then one day, you get caught with some drugs. And now because you're black and you're poor, you go to jail. And when you get out, nobody's going to hire you. And so therefore, you go back into a cycle. So now it's not just that you're in this negative cycle and you're depressed. More likely than not, based upon what has happened to you in jail, you're more inclined to be angry at the world and lash out. He said, that's what we see in our society, and we're not dealing with it. And he's right, we're not. And that's unfortunate. So this article from the University of British Columbia is saying, if you're down and out in life, stop thinking down and out. Remember something in your life that allowed you to feel good about yourself. If it was a relationship or for things you did with your family or something you might have achieved, focus on that and keep focusing until you can get back up on your feet. I found that so many people used to do the New York City Marathon. We're talking about 400 or 500 people would train year in, year out for over 30 years to do the New York City Marathon. Less so today because so many people from our audience have done it. But there was a time when we had 1,500 people show up to train starting in April for the New York City Marathon. And I had a chance, since we were working with them every single week, to talk with them about, why are you doing this? I can't tell you how many of them were doing it because they wanted to do something unique in their life, something that they could be proud of and others would be proud of them for having done it. Because it's such a Herculean effort to do a marathon. No matter where you come in the marathon, you get a medal around your neck. And everyone's smiling. And you have 2 or 3 million people cheering you on. And there are times, depending upon your training and if you've done it right or wrong, where you don't think you can continue, and that little boost of adrenaline from the people gets you going again. And you finish and thought, wow. 2 minutes after you finish, you think, I could do that again. And I learned what I should do this time. But you feel good about yourself. And you realize, there's nothing going to stop me. Nothing. No circumstance. And I found so many people coming who had not achieved anything in their life that they felt strong about. And this gave them something to feel really good about. So just remember, athletics is one way to build character, if done right. Social commitments and working towards a better society, helping those in need, that builds character. Working on yourself to master something with a discipline, emotional, spiritual, intellectual, physical discipline, that's something. All of these count more than how much money you got in the bank. So I'm very happy to know that they're giving us information on how to feel better about yourself. Next up, flax seeds can help lower blood pressure. Well, that's a big deal when you consider how many Americans between 60 and 70 million have some form of high blood pressure, hypertension. In fact, 1/3 of all adults have high blood pressure, and that puts you at risk of a heart attack, a stroke, kidney disease, and chronic heart failure. So bringing that blood pressure down will make an enormous difference. And flax seeds could be the inexpensive, easy, non-toxic way of lowering blood pressure. This study was split into two groups. And one got the flaxseed, about 30 grams. That's a little over an ounce, barely, 28.35 grams to an ounce. And the other did not. They were taking it into a muffin. So one got a muffin without flaxseed, one didn't. And what they found was that the flaxseed group saw a decrease of 15 points from their systolic blood pressure rating. That's major compared to the other group that didn't. Quote, from the American Society of Hypertension, the study results are indeed surprising. It's actually hard to imagine such reductions in blood pressure with flaxseed mixed in foodstuffs. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension. Quote, flaxseed induced one of the most potent anti-hypertensive effects achieved by a dietary intervention, end quote. So here we have a major study by a major orthodox mainstream institution published in a mainstream peer-reviewed journal, and it's saying what you have known all along. That's why you take your flaxseed or your powder or your flaxseed oil. Now, mind you, that's just one item. Could you imagine if you start using all the other things that help lower blood pressure too, like garlic and onions and vitamin E, coenzyme Q10 and vitamin C? Oh, yeah, those will bring your blood pressure down too. And near the end here, could your digestive problems be solved by eating GMOs? Well, here's what is said here. Quote, genetically modified organisms are found in an estimated 80% of grocery store foods. In all reality, it's extremely difficult to avoid them. And while we are very much in favor of sustainable, organic, non-GMO agriculture, we know eating completely non-GMO can be difficult. This difficult endeavor may be just what the naturopath ordered for the many people suffering from digestive ailments. Evidence exists that could tie the growing prevalence of GMO foods to the growing prevalence of digestive problems like leaky gut syndrome, irritable bowel syndrome, even chronic fatigue. This was reported in Green Med Info. Sarah G is doing a good job over there, and keep it up, buddy. Leaky gut syndrome, we know, is a relatively old new phenomenon over the last 20 years, and it affects a lot of people. It occurs when valves or barriers within the digestive system leak slightly due to damage. And this can allow food and waste and toxins to enter the bloodstream, triggering an immune response. And while it's only partially understood at this point, there are indications that our growing dependence on processed, even GMO foods, could have created the illness and the problems behind it. This is from Dr. David Hartz, North Florida Spine and Wellness Institute. Quote, one of the many toxins we find that are negatively impacting people's health are genetically modified organisms. Many people have no idea how GMOs negatively affect their health until they remove them from their diet and until they deal with the toxins accumulated in the body, in your organs, cellular and intracellular fluids, and positive changes begin to occur when you eliminate them, end quote. So, what better way of cleansing your body than to go on a purely organic program for 30 days. If it's not certified organic, don't eat it. And that way, by juicing every day, you'll help eliminate a lot of the negatives by taking probiotics, now glutamine and D-ribose. You'll help rebuild your gut, get it the energy it needs. So, undo some of the damage. And finally, junk food can harm your memory in 1 week. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Brain, Behavior, and Immunity. Here's what it says. I'll quote it. Even a short-term diet of junk food can have a detrimental effect on the brain's cognitive ability. Whoa. For the first time, researchers have shown that rats fed a diet high in fat and sugar had impaired memory after just 1 week. Interestingly, the results were similarly poor for the rats fed healthy diet and given access to sugar, water to drink. The cognitive impairment related to place recognition with the animals, showing poor ability to notice when an object had been shifted to a new location. And it was also shown that they had inflammation in the region of the brain associated with memory. Quote, "We know that obesity causes inflammation in the body, but we didn't realize until recently that it also causes changes in the brain." And that's from Professor Margaret Morris of the School of Medicine, Medical Sciences. Quote, "What is so surprising about this research is the speed with which the deterioration of the cognitive factors occurred. Our preliminary data also suggest that the damage is not reversed when the rats are switched back to a healthy diet, which is very concerning." Yeah. Well, for a simple reason. Because you're not repairing the DNA. We know how to reverse inflammation damage and repair the DNA. And that will be on an upcoming program, and I'll discuss that in some depth. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. And now I want to hit something on the environmental segment of our program. And we want to thank all of you who email us about listening in or going to the website and downloading the articles. We have all these progressive-themed articles. And on an upcoming program, I'm going to explain very comprehensively the difference between the old form of liberalism and conservatism and neoliberalism and FDR liberalism and current Obama-Clinton liberalism versus progressivism, so that it makes more sense to you. Then you'll understand why the people on MSNBC and NPR and PBS and many programs on Pacifica are really corporate-minded programs and not true. They're not progressive at all. But we'll get to that. In any case, from Dar Jamil, an article in Tom Dispatch entitled, "Are We Falling Off the Climate Precipice?" I'll just share a few paragraphs that I thought were important here. It gives us something to think about. "I grew up planning for my future, wondering which college I would attend, what to study, and later on, where to work, which articles to write, what my next book might be, how to pay a mortgage, and which mountaineering trip I might take next. Now I wonder about the future of our planet. During a recent visit with my 8-year-old niece, I stopped myself from asking them what they wanted to do when they grew up or any of the future-oriented questions I used to ask myself. I did so because the reality of their generation may be that questions like that would be replaced. Where will they get their fresh water? What food will be available? What parts of their country and the rest of the world will still be habitable? The reason, of course, is climate change. And just how bad it might be in coming home to us is what I'm asking. In 2010, this summer, I was climbing Mount Rainier in Washington State, taking the same route I had used in 1994 to the ascent. Instead of experiencing the metal tips of the crampons attached to my boots crunching into the ice of a glacier to hold my balance, I was aware that at high altitudes, they were still scraping against exposed volcanic rock. In the pre-dawn night, sparks shot from my steps. The route had changed dramatically enough to stun me. I paused at one point to glance down the steep cliffs at a glacier bathed in soft moonlight 100 meters below. It took my breath away when I realized that I was looking at what was left of the enormous glacier I had climbed in 1994. The one that, right on this spot, had left those crunching spikes on the ice. I stopped in my tracks, breathing the rarefied air of such altitudes, my mind working hard to grasp the climate change-induced drama that had unfolded since I was last here. I haven't returned to Mount Rainier to see just how much further the glacier has receded in the last 3 years, but recently I went on a search to find out just how bad it might turn out to be. I discovered a set of perfectly serious scientists, not the majority of all climate scientists by any means, but thoughtful outliers who suggest that it isn't really, really bad. It's catastrophic. Some of them even think that If the record ongoing releases of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, thanks to the burning of fossil fuels, are aided and abetted by massive releases of methane, an even more powerful greenhouse gas, life as we humans know it will be about to end on this planet. They fear that we may be and at and over a climate change precipice, hair-raisingly quickly. Mind you, the more conservative climate science types, represented by the prestigious Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, paint scenarios that are often modestly less hair-raising. But let's spend a little time, as I've done, with what might be called scientists at the edge and hear what they have to say. We've never been here as a species. We as a species have never experienced 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Who said that? Person who appears on this program in the past, Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson. And he's a professor of evolutionary biology and natural resources and a college, University of Arizona. And he's a climate change expert and talking about this for over 25 years. And he told me, quote, "We've never been on a planet with no Arctic ice and will hit the average of 400 parts per million within the next few years." We're talking about 2 or 3 years. At that time, we'll also see the loss of Arctic ice in the summers. This planet has not experienced an ice-free Arctic for at least 3 million years, end quote. Whoa. For the uninitiated, in the simplest terms, here's what an ice-free Arctic would mean when it comes to heating the planet. Minus the reflective ice cover on Arctic waters and solar radiation that would be absorbed, not reflected, by the Arctic Ocean. That would heat those waters because there's nothing, when the sun comes down, there's nothing to bounce it back into the atmosphere like ice. It's just going to go right into the water. And those are shallow waters, sometimes only 500 feet. And that's going to go down there and that's going to warm up the permafrost on the bottom. And that's going to cause it to melt and cause massive amounts of methane gas to be released, far more toxic to the environment than carbon dioxide. That is a big deal. And then on top of that, you have to look at the idea that that would heat those waters and hence the planet further. And this effect has the potential to change global weather patterns, vary the flow of winds, and even someday possibly alter the position of the jet stream. And polar jet streams are fast-flowing rivers of wind positioned high in the Earth's atmosphere that push cold and warm air masses around. That plays a critical role in determining the weather of our planet. Now, Professor McPherson, who maintains the blog Nature Bats Last, added, quote, "We've never been here as a species, and the implications are truly dire and profound for our species and the rest of the living planet." Now, while his perspective is more extreme than that of the mainstream scientific community, which sees true disaster several decades into our future, he's far from the only scientist expressing such concerns. Professor Peter Wadhams, a leading Arctic expert at Cambridge University, has been measuring Arctic ice for 40 years, and his findings underscore McPherson's fears. Quote, "The fall off in ice volume is so fast, it's going to bring us to zero very quickly." With 95% confidence, he says, the Arctic will have completely ice-free summers in 4 years. British scientist John Nyssen, chairman of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, of which Wadhams is a member, suggested if the summer sea ice loss passes, quote, "the point of no return and catastrophic Arctic methane feedbacks kick in, we'll be in the instant planetary emergency." McPherson, Wadham, Nyssen represent just the tip of a melting iceberg of scientists who are now warning us about looming disaster, especially involving Arctic methane releases in the atmosphere. Methane is a greenhouse gas that, on a relatively short-term time scale, is far more destructive than carbon dioxide. It is 2,300% more powerful. That's 2,300% more powerful than CO2 per molecule on a 100-year timescale. It's 10,000% more potent when it comes to heating the planet on a 20-year timescale. And the Arctic permafrost, onshore and off, is packed with this stuff. The seabed is there. According to Wadham, quote, is offshore permafrost, but is now warming and melting. We are now seeing great plumes of methane bubbling up in the Siberian Sea, millions of square miles where methane cover is being released, end quote. According to a study just published in Nature Geoscience, twice as much methane as previously thought is being released from the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, a 2 million square kilometer area off the coast of northern Siberia. Its researchers found that at least 17 teragrams, that's 1 million tons, of methane are being released into the atmosphere each year. So that's a tremendous increase. The day after Nature Geoscience released its study, a group of scientists from Harvard and other leading academic institutions published a report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences showing that the amount of methane being emitted in the United States from both oil and agricultural operations could be 50% greater than previous estimates and 1.5% times higher than estimates from the EPA. How serious is the potential global methane buildup? Not all scientists think it's an immediate threat or even the major threat we face, but Ira Leifer, an atmospheric and marine scientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and one of the authors of the recent Arctic methane study, pointed out, quote, the Permian mass extinction that occurred 250 million years ago is related to methane and thought to be the key to what caused the extinction of most species on the planet, end quote. In that extinction episode, it is estimated that 95% of all species were wiped out. It's also known as the Great Dying. It was triggered by massive lava flow in an area of Siberia that led to an increase in global temperatures by 6 degrees Celsius. That in turn caused the melting of frozen methane deposits under the seas. Released into the atmosphere, it caused temperatures to skyrocket. All this occurred over a period of approximately 80,000 years. We're currently in the midst of what scientists consider the sixth mass extinction in planetary history, and that we're losing about 200 species a day. Let me repeat that. Between 150 and 200 species a day are going extinct, a pace 1,000 times greater than the natural background extinction rate. This event may already be comparable to or even exceed both the speed and intensity of the Permian mass extinction, the difference being that ours is human-caused. It's not going to take 80,000 years. So just want to share that with you from our environmental segment. So what can we do? Well, first, become aware of the problem, and let's get off all animal products. That's 18% of the problem right there. That's something we could do. Go vegan. That's a big plus. And then we have to demand that we go to geothermal. It is the safest, most abundant natural energy source on the planet. And it's renewable, 10,000 times more hot water under that surface that could be heating whole cities and used for major industries. The technology is there, but there's no political will for it. Let's make that happen. And then just be aware, many people are going to be moving to higher altitudes. Big mistake. You're thinking, if it's going to be global warming, which means it's going to be hot in the south, I better go to where it's cool. Just the opposite. I'll go into that in greater detail, what happens when the ecosystem, the forest, dry out, beetles devastate whole areas, then you become right in the middle of a fire pit, and the drought then becomes severe, and then the winters are worse and the summers are worse. You're going to get slammed every way. More of the best places to live upcoming. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go to our guest who is standing by in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Charles Eisenstein, in just a moment. Just a little background on Charles. As I mentioned earlier, he is an independent scholar who writes about civilization, economics, and the evolution of human culture, and the spiritual challenges of coping with a society and a world in chaos. He is the author of The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, a collection of essays which offers an alternative story of humanity as an antidote to the malaise and frustration and paralysis preventing people from being vehicles for change. His website is charleseisenstein.net. And he also has degrees in mathematics and philosophy from Yale, and he's been active with other visionaries to develop progressive models of business and charity based upon a deeper ethical standard. So I'm looking forward to speaking with him about how to cope in such a chaotic mess of a world today in just a few moments. But we are the number one listened to progressive radio station in the world. Why? Because we don't sell you politics or personal ideologies. We just look for the truth and information that can empower you. And no one raises any money on any of the programs. Once a week, for about 3 minutes, I give you an update on something that you can call in, order, and that's what pays the bills. Today, it's the first time we're offering ever a duo of our number one and number two best products, green stuff and red stuff. For those of you who know you got to get your fruits and get your vegetables, this is one good way to make sure that happens. These are the big 500-gram sizes. What's in them that makes them so good and so important for you? Well, just imagine all the fruits and vegetables that you're not getting on a regular basis. Think of all the things that we should be eating. You hear about superfoods. Those are the foods that, well, you know, that's really special, but I don't have any of that in my system. Why not? Well, because I just haven't got it. Okay, so we put it in here. Now let me tell you what's in the red stuff, which is vegan, no GMOs, gluten-free, and Circle K kosher. It only has 54 calories, which is good for everyone. It has apple pectin, 4,000 milligrams, cherry juice, strawberry juice, blueberry, blackberry, cranberry, raspberry, pineapple, apricot, mango, peach, pear, watermelon, all that together. And it's sweetened with stevia. It has a wonderful berry flavor. That's the red stuff. Fruit, berries, pectins, what we need and we're not getting. And then you get into the green stuff, and you're getting the wheatgrass and spirulina and all these wonderful vegetables. Now, normally it's $79.95 for the green stuff, and it's $109.95 for the red stuff, and you're getting the red stuff for $59 and the green stuff for $49. It's a great value. I'm going to give you the phone number to call in and place your order. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. We were out of red stuff for a long period of time, but now it's back, and so now you can get it. Green stuff and red stuff, you get your fruits, you get your vegetables, they're in concentrate, they're raw food, they're wonderful. You put them in your smoothie in the morning. All right? That's our special. Now, to our theme of the day, and let's go over and say hello to Charles. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Gary. Good to be back.
Thank you. Charles, we could approach the topic of how to confront the numerous challenges we face as individuals and as a society and as a species that is endangering itself on the path to self-genocide from a wide variety of angles. However, you mentioned before this interview that one of your observations when you are traveling and lecturing and teaching is that people most often raise questions regarding the deep despair they experience about what is happening around them. So perhaps we should look at this issue of despair first as a starting platform to other questions. And why is despair such a powerful emotional state? What do you believe is its source? And finally, What is the antidote for not allowing it to incapacitate ourselves from becoming who we truly are as members of a wider global human community that is setting a course leading towards our own self-destruction?
Well, you know, one, on the most obvious level, despair is pretty unavoidable when you hear things like the stuff you were sharing 5 minutes ago about methane and the likely fate of our civilization, barring some miracle. You know, even if it wouldn't take a technological miracle, even if we already have things like geothermal and lots of other technologies, it would still take a political miracle to avoid the scenario of, I don't know, 4 or 6 degree temperature rise. And so despair is kind of baked into that cake. But on a deeper level, despair is built into our worldview that says that the way the universe works is that, you know, you're a separate being in an objective reality of impersonal forces that reality changes only when a force is exerted. And here you are, one individual. You know, how much force do you have at your disposal compared to the military, industrial, pharmaceutical, prison, financial complex? You know, how much force do you have? And what does it matter if you go vegan, or if you recycle, or if you angrily demand geothermal be implemented on a mass scale and buildings be retrofitted and all these other things? Like, what does it matter when you're one voice up against the mainstream media and the propaganda machine and the surveillance state? And so there's kind of despair built into the worldview that says that you're just this separate individual, and therefore that nothing that you do really matters. I mean, maybe if you can organize, if you have your own radio show, you know, like, and you're speaking to millions and coordinating them, then maybe what you do matters. But most of your listeners aren't doing that. They're just one person. And so I find that a lot of this narrative is in some way, and a lot of people reflect this back to me, that it's in some way disempowering. And it's the naive people who somehow still believe that their small actions make a difference, that actually do anything. And I think that there's kind of a clue in all of this, that our salvation is going to come from a worldview in that no longer holds us powerless as individuals, and therefore implicates kind of a different law of reality, a different understanding of how change happens in the universe. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that for now, because I don't want to run on and on.
And these are legitimate. I believe we can be very optimistic in the face of something that is so catastrophic, providing that we have the tools of knowledge. Look, if I'm able to know that I've got a problem, and if I get ahead of the problem, I might be able to resolve it at some level, or at least not be victimized by it. That's better than being blindsided. You know, there's a difference between proof that we're always asking for and certainty that is going to come. It was Nietzsche who said there are no facts, only interpretations. Mm-hmm. And we see how that is happening all the time. So, yes, I've worked for 7 years on this film on the 12 tipping points. Four of those are tipping and two have tipped. Uh-huh. They're not coming back. But that doesn't mean that it's fatalistic. It just means that, okay, now we must adjust to the circumstances that we have helped create. It's not about blaming. It's about, okay, where should I live? What could I do? What other things do I need in order to have quality of life? So could you take us to this place? I'm reminded of the literal translation of Gandhi's term, Satyagrama, which is truth force. Mm-hmm. Which was the essential foundation of his entire movement. When we look at the great despair of the Indian citizen under British colonialism, Gandhi was able to empower the population with deep spiritual principles of nonviolence that mobilized hundreds of thousands of Indians into a viable and powerful movement of social, sacred activism that ultimately brought down British rule. And of course, this movement was also a major influence on Martin Luther King's protests against what we can call American racial apartheid in the 1960s. And Gandhi was cognizant that not only was every person capable of connecting with the force of truth in the same way or with the same commitment and determination as he did, some people have stronger convictions, are capable of putting themselves on the front lines, whereas others are only capable of being in the back lines or just there as a support system. So please take us through your perspective on the need for people who feel disempowered, frustrated, and angry, but are unable to mobilize themselves to connect with that greater force of truth within themselves to be motivated to enact positive change, and how are some of the ways they can accomplish this?
Yeah, Gandhi was, in addition to being a truth teller, he was also an amazing storyteller in the sense that, you know, how do you get hundreds of thousands or millions of people to do things like, you know, go to the ocean and make salt? Such an act would be meaningless outside of the context for that he created. And he was also, and I think that part of the value of what you're doing also is being a truth teller, to put into words and into consciousness this kind of dread feeling that we have that there's something terribly amiss in our world, which our daily experience often contradicts. You know, there's part of me even that says, well, things couldn't really be so bad when, you know, look at what people are talking about and thinking about. Look at the headlines in the newspaper, you know, in the media. It's about Kim Kardashian, you know, it's about sports, you know, it's about all this trivia. So things couldn't really be that bad. But we all have a sense that things are terribly wrong, that the world shouldn't be this way, that life is supposed to be more beautiful and authentic and you know, that and we also all feel on some level the anguish of our planet because we're not really separate beings. And so it's really important to have voices that say, yeah, you're right, because that empowers action. I think that despair, though, in a way, it's an escape into a story that expresses this wound that we carry, but it diverts us from what really empowers us, which is the experience of grief. Despair is kind of an escape valve from grief. And I think that if we want to inspire people to become environmentalists, to become people who, you know, take action, despair and isn't going to do it. That's paralyzing. And neither ultimately is fear. And a lot of the appeals that environmentalists use to try to stir people into action, to try to incite people, are basically saying, if we don't take action, then we're not going to have a planet to live on. They're trying to, in a way, it's a very subtle application of the technology of force or the mentality of force that is parallel to the same kinds of technologies that have caused these problems to begin with. And it says that the way to make somebody change is to appeal to their self-interest, to appeal to their fear, or maybe to appeal to their to use shame and conditional approval and so on to kind of make people do things that would ordinarily be against their self-interest. But I find that, in fact, when I look at how I became an environmentalist and how people become environmentalists, it's not because they're scared into it. It's because they've had an experience of beauty and usually grief also. And so it comes from love, really, not from fear. Yeah, it comes from love and not from fear. So I think that we really have to remember that, because so many of the arguments that I see, like, for example, economic arguments, you know, the economic value of ecosystem services, the medicines that can be made from the biodiverse plants in the rainforest, you know, economic costs of sea level rising, you know, these don't engage our love for this planet. And when we appeal, and it's really almost like appealing to the mentality of money too, you know, and of self-interest, and it only creates very superficial activism, no commitment. So I think that, yeah, to sum it up, we have to move, and this is maybe what you could call sacred activism, moving to the level of feeling, of grief, of beauty, of love, that underlies any real transformation of our society.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate those insights. Thank you for that. Wasn't it, I'm pretty sure that it was Aung San Suu Kyi who said, "It is not power that corrupts, but fear. The fear of losing power corrupts those who wield it, and the fear of the scourge of power corrupts those who are subject to it." Mm. And in that context, I see in movements like the environmental movement sometimes can be corrupted by people who one day realize they're making $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year and have been for a long time, and that's created a comfort zone for them. So they're not going to really put their energy on what really is the solution, but they'll continue doing this kind of tap dance around the issues. The same has happened in the health movement and other movements. Some of the so-called holistic doctors are charging more money and are just as insensitive as some of the orthodox doctors that people thought, well, a holistic doctor will treat me like a whole person. So I think that it ends up that we fear not being able to control the circumstances that we're involved in. So what in the world are we going to do? And that's where I believe that Gandhi's insights and Martin Luther King's insights and what you're sharing with us, your insights, are so important for us. You know, that don't start your journey from fear. Don't start it from apathy. Don't start it from depression. Don't start it from rage. Start it from where ideally you believe it can happen. Look, I just finished building a whole veterans village. Now, one year and 2 months ago, I was standing in a forest at 40 degrees, and I saw homeless vets. And when I saw that they had no food, one guy hadn't eaten in 3 days, and he had blood stains on his shirts where he'd had two stents put in from a heart condition, and it was infected, and he showed me this crumpled up little piece of paper, which a prescription, but he didn't have the money to get the prescription for the antibiotics to help protect his life. And he was so weak that he could barely walk. Well, needless to say, I jumped in, I helped him, got his prescription all, but I couldn't help all 16,000. You heard me right, 16,000 homeless vets living in Central Florida in the woods, decided to ban them. Now imagine sitting with those people and asking about, what are you going to do? How are you going to get out of this? There was total apathy where they had simply resigned. As one guy said, there's nowhere I can go because there's nothing I can do when I get there. I was in New Orleans. Nothing improved. I went here. Nothing improved. He says, so each day we just wait for the day to start and the day to end, and we talk amongst ourselves. So I said, well, what if? What if what? What if there was a place where you could go, where you could be with your families, where you could get the kind of emotional help from holistic psychologists and behavioralists and holistic physical health to get your bodies detox from Gulf War syndrome, and where you could get rehabilitation, and if it cost you nothing? He said, well, man, he said, sign me up. And so I did. I went out and I found a place, and it's opening in about 2 months from now. So you start with an idea that the circumstances of what you're facing may be horrific and overwhelming and catastrophic for the million homeless vets and another million vets who are on disability. You're talking about 2 million people. But it doesn't mean it has to stay that way. All it takes is one example of what we can do to overcome a problem to show that we can overcome a problem.
Yeah.
All it takes is one. And then suddenly you got 20 vets who are now getting their lives back, reentering society without killing themselves or someone else or suicide and off the drugs. And now you make the American and the world public aware it works. Now other people can do it in their communities. So that's where I believe that we can come from. So we get by fear, we get by apathy, we get by anger, we get by some of these things that are self-limiting. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah. You never know what the effect will be, even of, like, helping one guy with his prescription. the cynical mind would say, well, you know, I'm just helping one guy. What could that possibly mean in the context of climate change or what's really happening at Fukushima or whatever, you know, macro problem? And to be really, really cynical, a climate change activist might even say, well, you know, Gary, you're really wasting your time because it doesn't matter what happens to those 20,000 homeless veterans in the context of global warming. And in fact, helping them might even make things worse because they're going to rejoin consumer society when they get back on their feet and they're going to consume more and have productive jobs in the economy. So, you know, maybe they're better off. Maybe the planet would be better off if they and 99% of all other humans died. But that kind of instrumental logic, I think, is part of the problem. It's part of that disempowering logic that leads to despair. And it conflicts with the logic of the heart, which when you are helping that guy with his prescription, you know that at that moment you could be doing nothing more important than that. You know that. And you know that on some level, through some mysterious way, every small action has global significance or even cosmic significance. And it's that knowledge that we need to reconnect people to and to live from ourselves. And in this case, you can, you know, because you have a lot of resources and you're, you know, a very creative and empowered person, you're not just helping one, and you are doing it in a way that is publicly visible and can become an example and cause larger change. But many people aren't in that situation, and their acts of kindness and generosity are seemingly invisible. You know, it could be a woman helping her grandmother, taking care of her grandmother every day after work, and all her friends are going out and they're developing their careers, and she's just taking care of an old woman, and nobody even appreciates it. And how is that changing the universe? But we know that it is, and I don't think anyone wants to live in a reality in which those acts of caring don't count or don't matter. So, and by the way, it's the same kind of instrumental logic. That's the logic of money and the logic of war, where this external macro end trumps everything that's right in front of our faces. And it's the mentality that allows us to treat nature, to treat local ecosystems, local nature, the animals right in front of us, the plants right in front of us, the soil, the water, this river, this hill, as, well, you know, it's just a bunch of stuff and it doesn't matter in the big picture. And so we can kind of bulldoze over it. That's the separation. It's the attitude of separation from material reality and from our matrix of relationships. That's really the problem. So I think that in a sense, we have to become irrational again. But it's not really irrational. It's just listening to a different kind of logic that says that everything we do is significant because we're not separate from everything.
Howard Zinn once wrote that hope is not a certainty but a possibility. And as a culture based upon Judeo-Christian religions, we are raised with this unconscious belief in certainty. And I believe that we have to allow ourselves to see what we can do against these absolute thoughts to regain our sense of empathy towards that one person, that older woman, because what you exchange in your care, your concern, your compassion, your help for that one person makes a difference. There is no such thing as not making a difference when you're engaging in something positive. It just may not be viewed or seen or appreciated, but it to the person that you're doing it with, it is making a difference. Charles, thank you. I appreciate you coming on and sharing, as always, some great insights with us, and all the best on the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Your
Thanks,
new
Gary.
Work.
Thanks.
All the best to you. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. My guest, Charles Eisenstein, an independent scholar, an author, and a philosopher. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I have an email here from France. Yes, you have international listeners. This is from Ellen. She says she's been living in France for the past year because of work, and she used to listen to you on PFW for the past 14 years. And she said, I met up with some people who listen to PRN, which has created a whole social circle of intellectual activists, very bright people, all acknowledged in their fields, and looking at all the issues that they want to address together, especially the global issues. The number one discussion for the past week and a half has been your article on the hidden hand. As one of my new friends said, it was right in front of us all along. Why didn't we see it? So she's asking, could you discuss on one of your programs the corrupting power of insecurity? We're having a meeting next Monday, and that's what we're going to be talking about. So she says any input would be appreciated. And she said, in my first 6 months here, I felt very alone. And she said, now I'm as engaged as I could be and happy as I was living in the hubbub of Washington, D.C., thanks to your PRN programming.
Now, that's nice to hear. I will address that issue on an upcoming program and be happy to take it on. But we're out of time for today, so... thank you, Luann. And let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Luann, if you're still there. Well, today it is open forum on Lead Stories, and usually that's where people take the conversation where they want it to go.
Great. We look forward to it right now.